This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Food, it puts me in a good mood. It keeps me going when under strains. Ain't nothing worse than hunger pains right there. Start with light fare if need be. Snacks with an X, whatever, just feed me some food. It puts me in a good mood.
Welcome to the AJ Podcast. I'm your host, Emily Slofstra, web editor at Alternatives Journal, Canada's environmental voice. Today we have two interviews with authors from the Food and Drink issue, which just landed on newsstands. Be sure to check out the magazine for the two authors that are in this podcast, as well as many other informative pieces. There's a piece about Ontario farmers that are growing world crops such as okra, you'll learn about how Israeli farmers are making wine in the desert, and AJ staff and friends tasted seven Canadian spirits, from whiskey to cherry liqueur, and we provided tasting notes and pairing suggestions in the magazine. You can also check out some pictures online at alternativesjournal.ca. You can order subscriptions on our website if you're interested in checking out the magazine, or visit alternativesjournal.ca/newsstand to buy the magazine in the store. In today's podcast, we first have an interview with Tarini Chopra. She wrote about GM alfalfa in the magazine, and I chatted with her to learn more about the Monsanto situation. In the article, you'll learn that Roundup Ready alfalfa has been improved in Canada, though it has yet to be sold, and it could be both an economic problem and an issue for our organic food system if it gets distributed. Tarini informed me that yes, the organic farmers that you buy food from, whether through a CSA or at the market, those farmers will be impacted by GM alfalfa, if it's used by other farmers. So be sure to listen in to learn what you can do to stop GM alfalfa from being used in Canada. For the second interview, Darren Kaster of the Green Majority talked to Chris Wood. An excerpt from Wood's book, Down the Drain, How We Are Failing to Protect Our Water Resources, appears in AJ on page 37. The excerpt focuses on First Nation reserves in Canada and how many of them do not have clean drinking water. In the interview, Darren and Chris talk about how the government's lack of care for our water might be impacting your genital equipment. And those are Chris's words, not mine. Music in this podcast is by Buck65, Old Man Ludica, and Betty Supple. Be sure to listen to the end of the show to catch Betty's song, Site 41, which is a great song about water politics. If you have songs about the environment, food, or any other topic that AJ might feature, send me an email at emily@alternativesjournal.ca, and I'd love to take a listen. Our upcoming issues are Night, Heroes, and Resource Conflicts. Here's Buck65 with Country Cookin'. Everybody wants a lot of avocado, and a chicken enchilada, watch Mare Wolf down, a 4-pound minimum, a chocolate chip cookies, a rice pudding with cinnamon, I'm starving for fried calamari with seaweed, trying to save room for strawberries and kiwi to satisfy, it'll take more than a little plate of french fries, falafels, waffles, or griddle cakes, all this might be enough, but I'm doubtful, so I'm gonna savor the flavor of every mouthful of food. It puts me in a good mood and keeps me going when under streams ain't nothing worse than hunger pains right there. Start with life fair if need be, snacks with an X, whatever, just feed me some food. It puts me in a good mood and keeps me going when under streams ain't nothing worse than hunger pains right there. Start with life fair if need be, snacks with an X, whatever, just feed me some food. This is the AJ Podcast. Here's Tarini Chopra on the problem that is genetically modified alfalfa in Canada. Learn more at alternativesjournal.ca or check out the Food and Drink issue for more information.
Roundup Ready alfalfa is a technology owned by Monsanto, and it's genetically engineered to be resistant to the glyphosate-based herbicide Roundup Ready. What that means is that, as with any Roundup Ready crop, GM alfalfa can be sprayed with Roundup and all the other plants die, but alfalfa does not. So this is a variety of alfalfa that is not on the market at the moment, but has been approved, and one variety has been registered to go on the market. And a lot of farmers are really worried about this because it has a whole bunch of negative impacts. And so the article looks at some of those impacts, but primarily at the risk of contamination from Roundup Ready alfalfa, which is very, very significant.
Right. So why is alfalfa so important?
That's a great question. Alfalfa is really a central crop in Canadian agriculture. It's used for a whole bunch of different purposes, but a really major one is that it's used as a very, very high quality, high protein feed for livestock. So that includes dairy cattle, dairy cows, beef cattle, and horses and sheep and other animals as well. And it's also a nitrogen fixer, like most other legumes. So it's used in farms to build up the soil, to increase fertility. It actually suppresses weeds, so it's used as a cover crop to keep other weeds down. And it's really good for preventing erosion and aerating the soil. So it's a really major crop, and it's grown in a very large part of the country. 38% of the organic acres in the country are under alfalfa at least, and that number might actually be higher. About the same percentage across the country, and 22% in Ontario. So 22% of Ontario's agricultural land is under alfalfa.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for the average consumer, mm-hmm. say someone who has a CSA, would our CSA farmers be planting alfalfa and be affected by it?
That's a great question. Yes. Yes is the short answer. The long answer is many different ways. So, for example, anyone who is raising animals would almost certainly have some alfalfa in their feed. Mm-hmm. If you are ever interacting with an organic farmer, whether it's at the market or in a CSA or anything like that, they depend on alfalfa in a really central way, partly for their animals, but also because many organic farmers will use it as a cover crop in between other crops to build up soil fertility. And because organic farmers don't use other nitrogen fertilizers, this is a really important source of nitrogen. And again, because organic farmers actually risk losing their business if any GM content is found in their products, the risk for them is very, very high. And conventional farmers, as I mentioned earlier, use it for pasture, for their animals. And a lot of farmers in Ontario actually save seed and sell seed, so save seed for themselves and also sell seed between farmers. And 8% of the country's alfalfa exports actually come from Ontario, and we're one of the five top exporters of alfalfa products in the world, so yeah, that's not a small proportion.
Yeah. And there would be some places we couldn't sell it to anymore.
That's right. So Europe essentially has not. I mean, no country in the world right now has actually approved GM alfalfa. We don't know which ones would or which ones wouldn't if we decided to start growing this stuff. But previous experiences from other crops like flax and canola have really shown that several countries in Asia, Japan, Taiwan, will not accept GM food or feed, and the EU is in a very similar situation. So, again, it's a really big risk to take for something we're not certain of.
Why would a farmer want to plant Roundup Ready alfalfa, and what types of farmers would be planting it?
Well, so there is the obvious convenience to Roundup Ready crops generally provide the convenience to chemical farmers that they can spray large areas of their field and it'll kill the weeds and not their crops. So of course for those farmers these crops are easier, they're convenient, they're often time-saving. But interestingly, in the case of alfalfa, that actually doesn't apply, and even several conventional farmers have come forward to say this is not actually a crop that we need or that we want and the risks are too high. And part of the reason for that is that most farmers, conventional, organic, whatever, don't actually use herbicides on alfalfa stands because they're grown either as pasture or as forage crop, and they don't need herbicides to grow. So they tend to suppress weeds. Once they come up, they take over themselves, they do their own thing. When you cut them, they come back on their own. The only time that farmers might be using herbicides around alfalfa stands is before planting to clear the field of whatever was there before, or right at the end of planting when you actually want to get rid of the alfalfa because it's helped you build up your soil and you want to put something else there. And that second purpose, which is quite important for a lot of conventional farmers, would actually be lost to them. Because, of course, if it was Roundup Ready alfalfa, they wouldn't be able to apply Roundup to get rid of that crop to put something else in. So the only time that farmers would be using herbicides on it essentially would be lost to them. And in Ontario specifically, where alfalfa is grown as forage more than for seed production or for dehydrated alfalfa products, farmers would be growing alfalfa with other grasses because it actually makes it an overall better forage, makes the stand last longer, it increases the palatability and the nutrient content. So again, any farmer who's growing a forage mix that includes alfalfa is not going to want a Roundup Ready crop because it would kill all the other grasses to apply alfalfa, to apply Roundup Ready to that field. So even the perceived benefits of Roundup Ready crops are not actually applicable to alfalfa. And alfalfa farmers, even those who are supportive of other GM technology and other GM crops, very many of them are not supportive of Roundup Ready alfalfa being released in eastern Canada.
So is there a chance that Roundup Ready alfalfa won't actually get out there and won't be used?
That's what we're hoping. That's what a lot of farmers are hoping and pushing for. The current status is that one variety of Roundup Ready alfalfa has been approved for registration. So essentially, the way the regulatory process goes is that any GM crop has to go through an approval with the CFIA, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, and with Health Canada. Roundup Ready alfalfa has gotten both those approvals. So technically, it is safe. Or it is considered safe for human consumption, for environmental release, and for animal feed. The last step before it can actually go to market is that it has to get this variety registration. And so far, only one variety has. But even that variety that has gotten variety registration has not been commercialized on the market. So farmers and consumers are putting pressure on the CFIA, on the Minister of Agriculture, and also on the company that would actually be distributing this crop, which is Forage Genetics International, which is actually based in Kitchener.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Has anyone done any protests there or mass visits?
There's been lots of protests. There was a National Day of Action against GE alfalfa. That was before the registration actually happened, so that was calling on MPs to actually not let the registration happen. I actually realized I made a mistake. It's not Forage Genetics that is based in Kitchener. It is the companies that have been given the distribution rights. So there's two other companies that will actually be selling this crop, Growmark and Gold Medal. And one of those companies is based here. Growmark is based here in Kitchener. But that's a very recent thing that's happened, the registration. But farmers have been calling on MPs to stop this crop, and on the Canadian Seed Trade Association, and on Forage Genetics.
So why would the Canadian government want Monsanto alfalfa or approve it in the first place?
It's a little bit of a mystery, to be honest. I'm not sure I fully understand. I mean, we do have a regulatory system that doesn't look at GMOs as being very different than other crops, which I think is dangerous, but is part of how the CFIA assesses these GM crops. I think that's one reason, a regulatory weakness and failure. The process also doesn't actually consult with farmers, so I honestly think there's some missing knowledge about what this means to farmers and whether or not farmers want GM alfalfa. There is no consultation process. There is no official process that looks at economic harm or social impact as far as GMOs is concerned. So I think there's some missing pieces to the puzzle. I think there's probably also some argument to the fact that there is a support of corporations instead of farmers in this process. So Monsanto is, has in many regulatory decisions in Canada been supported by government decisions, while full implications of those approvals to consumers, farmers, eaters hasn't really been looked at. So I think there's another bigger picture issue of corporate control and what it really means to all the rest of us in this decision.
Yeah, there's a lot out there about Monsanto, so
tons.
People can go Google that one.
Tons.
Just to learn
more. Not hard to find.
Yeah. Is there anything consumers can do to help out?
Absolutely. There's a couple of things. The big action right now is, again, to remind our MPs that this is not something that farmers or consumers want. Because this registration has happened during the growing season, farmers are, of course, too busy to really be able to leave their fields to take up the issue. So it really is more in consumers' and eaters' hands than it's been before. So calling on our MPs to not let this crop go to market, reminding them to read the contamination report that has been produced by the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network. Writing letters to the company is a possibility, though so far we haven't had a lot of dialogue, so I don't know how effective that one is. And writing letters to the Minister of Agriculture, Jerry Ritz, again, to call for a moratorium on actually releasing the crop in Eastern Canada.
So the companies that distribute it, do they distribute other GM seeds as well?
I'm not actually sure. Gold Medal, which is the Canadian, the company that has the Canadian registration process, mostly cleans forage seed, cleans and distributes forage seed. So, and because this is the first genetically modified forage seed in Canada, I doubt that they distribute other GM seed. And I'm sure the other companies probably do, because in Canada we have four crops that are GM, soy, canola, corn, and sugar beet. And so, of course, pretty much all companies that do larger scale distribution would be distributing at least one, if not all, of those cereal crops.
So at least one company might be willing to dialogue about it, hopefully.
Hopefully. And I think the thing is, again, because this is now a possibility that it might go on the market, like, it's a new discussion that we weren't really having with companies before, that farmers weren't really voicing to companies how much they didn't want this crop. It was more aimed at sort of letting the CFI know that there was really high risks and that farmers didn't want to have to take on those risks, and that there's very significant implications for export harm and contamination. But now that the crop has been registered, it's definitely time to start telling seed distribution companies that neither consumers nor farmers actually want this crop to be on the market.
Is there somewhere people can go online that would have, say, a list of names and people to contact?
Mm-hmm. There's a couple places. The National Farmers Union website, so nfu.ca, and the National Farmers Union Ontario websites both have information. And then the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network, which is at cban.ca, has a section on alfalfa and gives all the different options for what you can do and who you can contact.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
That was Tarani Chopra talking about the problem of GM alfalfa. This is the AJ podcast, and you can learn more about Roundup Ready alfalfa and much more at alternativesjournal.ca, or pick up the magazine on a newsstand near you. Here's Big Group Breakfast by Old Man Ludica, and up next, Darren Kaster of the Green Majority interviews Chris Wood about his book Down the Drain: How We Are Failing to Protect Our Water Resources.
There's sun in the steam of the coffee cups. Lingers round the table and warms us up. Where will you go next? What do you do? Really nice last night having drinks with you. You might be nostalgic about this, and that's just one small part of bliss. Fine folk, no need to talk much in the woozy spaces, 'cause there's understanding on our boozy faces. You might be nostalgic about this, that's just one small part of bliss. Yeah.
So we're talking to Chris Wood today, who is coming to us as a journalist of over 30 years. And I hear as well that you have memorized the names of the capital cities of every country in the world. Is that correct, Chris?
Every single one, yes.
Absolutely. And so we're going to be talking to you mostly about your most recent publication, which is Down the Drain, How We're Failing to Protect Our Water Resources. I'm particularly interested in this topic because it's something that actually before I even got to a university level, most of the opportunities I had to do self-directed research was on water issues. And so I've actually read quite a bit on this. So the first thing I want to start off with you, though, Chris, is I've just read through your prologue, which is available on your website, easily Googleable by looking for Chris Wood. And I just used the word water, popped up as the first response. We will, of course, have links to all this, of course, as well. But the first thing that I've just read the prologue, it's only about 4 pages long, and immediately you can sort of tell here that you're going after some really big, critical, but like concept issues. A lot of these, to me, it didn't start off as a book about, here's a couple of concerns and here's maybe some things we could do about them and then get into talking about them. You sort of right off the bat knock off 7, 8 big sort of concept issues that most people don't even think about. So I'd like to ask you just to start, tell me about who were you writing this for? Who's your intended audience that you think needs to have this information?
Well, that's an awful big invitation to any author. I think there are layers of audience that I hope will come to this book. At the end of the day, or the beginning of the day, certainly the beginning of the book, as we point out in the prologue that, as you mentioned, is online, water is everything that we have that is worth having. You have to have water for your iPod to get made. You have to have water for your arugula salad to get grown. We have to have water for everything. And everything that we do affects our water. So in one sense, when you write about water and the perils that it faces and the perils that we face because our water is in danger, you're writing for everybody. I mean, you're writing for everybody who brushed their teeth this morning. More particularly, of course, we were writing, Ralph and I, for people who are in a position to make change. That includes, frankly, folks like yourself who are doing shows like this. It includes politicians. It includes the people we don't often think about as voters, but who are so important up and down the structure of provincial and federal ministries that make a lot of the decisions that affect our water. I wrote it for people who are concerned about water in their backyard, more or less literally. You know, people who are concerned about their watershed, people who are aware that their business faces particular water constraints. That includes everybody who has any connection with the agriculture industry. Also includes people who have any connection with the oil, gas, and the natural gas industries, which are huge water consumers. But it's written for every Canadian, but I particularly hope it reaches Canadians who are engaged in their life, their community, and see that it's up to us to insist that things be better handled than they have been.
Now, I'm sure you, Chris, and probably our audience was just thinking that was a rather odd place for me to start before we even got into talking about what your book was. The reason I chose to start there was because I actually couldn't decide. A lot of the time when you're trying to tell a story, you want to have in mind who you're telling it to. But you've in 300 pages, if your prologue is any indication, have been able to deal with what looks like sort of every conceivable, as far as I could think of, way to look at this. You talk about sort of how we think about wealth and like worldview concepts. You've got the structure, how the country is structured and how not just the Canadian political climate, but how the history of Canadian politics affects these sorts of choices. You get into basically every possible issue here. That's why I was so interested just to see sort of who your intended audience would have primarily been.
Well, in a way, that's kind of unavoidable. This is the second book I've written about water. And you know the problem with water? The damn stuff just spreads, you know? So once you start talking about it, it gets into everything else. And that is particularly true. You cannot intelligently address a narrow part of the water issue, say the contaminants that are in our tap water, which, you know, where pharmaceuticals and exotic chemicals are showing up more and more and having weird effects on gender balances. You can't talk about that without talking about how those compounds get into the water. You can't talk about how those compounds get into the water without talking about how we use landscapes. All of a sudden, you're talking about agriculture. And, you know, to claim we've talked about everything is a boast I certainly won't make. There's an awful lot of stuff that, in fact, we had to leave out. There's other material which has come to light even in the time since the book was put to bed for publication. Water moves and is a dynamic subject. But what we wanted to do is reflect and recognize that if we're going to talk usefully about water, whether questions of quantity, are we going to have enough of it, or questions of safety, is it clean enough, we have to talk about a very significant number of other areas. And those do include those issues of how we got here politically and legally. They include how we make our decisions. And most of the decisions we make around water are made politically. Others are made in the business environment. But we didn't want it to get, you know, lost in this kind of octopus of subject areas. And that's why we anchored the book around the two central questions which appear about halfway through. And those are, having established, we hope to reader satisfaction, certainly to ours, that Canada has taken absolutely appalling care of our water. We ask, okay, maybe that's worth it if it's making us richer. And even if we're taking appalling care of water in the wild, is that actually maybe making us healthier? Who knows? Maybe we're better off than we were a century ago. And in both cases, you know, what we find, I think, is that, yeah, in some respects, we certainly made a bunch of money with our water. But the tide is turning, not to you know, be too funny about it, but we're in a position now where the damage that we're doing to our water is costing us more than the money we're making from it. In the case of health, we've been very successful at beating back the kinds of diseases that killed dozens, scores of people in the Great Lakes 100 years ago before we began really getting serious about the sanitation of drinking water. We've gotten very good at things like typhoid and cholera, but all of a sudden we find that we're awash in this this evolving ecology of exotic chemicals designed to do very active things in biology, very much like ours. Those chemicals wind up in the water, and gosh, they're continuing to act on our biology, and we're seeing some really disturbing effects that we describe in the book, particularly around around sex, around, not to be too fine a point on it, around boys' genital equipment. These are pretty weird things that are going on that trace back to how we're managing our water. So as much as we've tried as much as we can to deal with those many, many aspects of the issue, our primary concerns are we getting richer or not, or poorer? Are we staying healthy or not? And ultimately, what does that mean for our future as Canadians in this landscape?
One of the phrases that you use in there is sort of an in-joke among environmentalists, which is that you sort of refer to the idea of people thinking that water comes from taps, and the saying goes, of course, that, you know, food comes from water comes from taps and food comes from grocery stores, was the one that I keep hearing, or at least my co-host keeps using that on the show. So, I mean, there's so much information here, I think, that it explains how we got where we are specifically as Canadians, and talks about what some of the consequences of that is. So with that sort of idea of, if more people knew about this information, they might make different choices, either personal choices or political choices. What of the information that you put in your book do you think is the most invisible to your average Canadian? What's the most critical thing that your average person doesn't know about?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. I think that the average Canadian, certainly the average Canadian who pays any attention to what's affecting their health, you know, whether that's street noise or you know, family stress, may well have heard of some of the particular health stressors that we're talking about. But I think that's an area where there's a good deal that's going to surprise and startle a lot of Canadians. But, you know, the part of the book which I think is really most critical for Canadians to absorb and understand that they have some power as a result of, is the section of the book towards the end where we argue that, you know, the governments do not have the option, however much they may pretend they do and put that belief into policy. Governments don't have the option of abandoning our natural security as Canadians. You know, we've gotten used to thinking, well, you know, you can fight the government, but you'll probably lose. That at the end of the day, governments will make up their minds about things. But there is a long and deep and in other places extremely powerful legal history. And it continues up to this day in the Canadian jurisprudence that says there are some things that governments just can't decline to do. You know, they can decline to subsidize university radio stations. They can decline to subsidize book publishers. They can decline to, build a particular highway or something. But there are some things that they can't just say, no, what, not going to do that. Those include maintaining the territorial integrity of the country. We don't want somebody coming along and carving off Newfoundland. So our government has, you know, maritime patrols and, you know, watches the borders. Another such responsibility is maintaining the currency. The Canadian dollar's got to be something we rely on to pay our bills, so that's one of the jobs. Political scientists refer to the keeping of internal order in the same category, that it's a responsibility of governments to make sure that we can walk safely down the streets. Well, something which I think Canadians need to become more aware of is that governments have the same order of responsibility to preserve our habitat. It really doesn't matter if the dollar is worth a whole pile of money or our borders are secure if we don't have enough clean water to maintain our agriculture, if we don't have enough clean water to maintain our homes and industry, or if the water that we're drinking is doing strange and exotic things that disrupt our families. That is what we call in the book natural security. And we've got a lot of emphasis by our government today on national security. We need to have more emphasis on natural security. And there are some very influential legal ideas where we draw from other countries where those ideas have had very significant successes in obliging governments to treat the environment better. Canadians need to access those, recognize that we could apply some of these in this country, and that we actually have the capacity to oblige our government to be a little trite about it, to stand on guard for our natural security as well as our borders and crossing points.
A lot of what you were talking about in the prologue was talking about government policy and the history. Of course, when you get into that, I didn't see anything there about multinational corporations. Can I get you to comment on the role of multinational corporations and the privatization of these resources like water?
That is a very, very large issue, and one that
maybe another book.
It kind of calls for another 300 pages. But I'll say a couple of things. I mean, multinational corporations can do a bunch of things which are not helpful to the environment. Some multinational corporations are doing some things that very effectively are reducing their impact on the environment. Those things should be encouraged. At the same time, we need a much larger argument about consumerism generally. And obviously, many multinational corporations depend for their wealth and their growth on our culture of consumerism. Frankly, we had enough to do dealing with water before we got into that.
Hmm. Well, I was thinking specifically, Chris, of issues like Nestle buying up public water to then resell to the public and dwindling resources and then selling what we do have sort of into private hands was what I was getting at.
What I have argued in other places and. We deal a little bit with this in this book, is that really what it comes down to is the activities are going to be done with water. Now, whether those include bottling it for convenient consumption or not, we're not going to shut down the economy, and we're probably not going to nationalize the entire economy. So every business that has something to do with water, which is to say pretty much every business, is going to be using some water. The question becomes, what rules do we put on how those businesses behave with water? What costs do we require them to acknowledge and accept to use that water? And when we're thinking about those costs, are we thinking just about the costs of, you know, sticking a hole in the ground and pumping up a bunch of water? Or are we thinking about the much larger question of what is it going to cost to preserve the ecosystems, preserve the hydrology that will keep those wells flowing for a long, long time? I don't have any problem as a citizen with Ontario, for example, allowing Nestle or some other company to remove water from an aquifer for some economically viable, profitable purpose. I have a huge problem if they allow that to happen irrespective of the supply of water in the aquifer, irrespective of other demands on that water, irrespective of the health of the ecosystems upstream, which capture that water from rain and snowfall, buffer it, filter it, and supply it to the aquifer. What we need is a much more thorough, much more honest accounting all of the natural resources that support our economy, and that means not just the fossil ones or the mineral ones, but the ecological ones as well. And however we accomplish it, and there's lots of different ways that might be done, but we need to find ways to be aware of how we may be damaging ecosystems, how not to do a damage ecosystems, and to charge the right entity for the cost of preserving our ecosystems. And if money is being made by a private company out of an ecosystem, then I think that private company needs to factor into its costs of production the cost of preserving on a sustainable basis the ecosystem. So I'm not against corporations. I'm against cheating accounting. And really, from the beginning of time until now, our accounting has been essentially fraudulent because it does not acknowledge environmental externalities or many others. So, again, good with business, bad on fraudulent accounting.
So we've only got a minute or two left. Chris, time's been flying by here talking to you. I'd like to ask you about... I'm in Ontario right now, and it's hard to be in Ontario and talk about water issues and not think about the Walkerton incident from many years ago. As far as with just your look at sort of how the policies are setting up, and you're talking about overlapping policies being hard to enforce because the water doesn't respect the same boundaries that that our politics does, and this sort of issue. Do you think that Canadians are at risk due to sort of a lack of policy overlap from another incident like Walkerton?
I think Canadians are at risk on a whole lot of fronts. It's not from a lack of policy overlap or from too much policy overlap. It has mostly to do with a lack of political will, particularly in the part of our federal government, to actually do anything much at all to defend our water. Most municipal water systems, whether they're Metro Toronto's or Walkerton's or Whistler British Columbia's, are essentially, in this country, public companies. That is not... As a public company, I mean stock-traded companies. I mean they're like crown companies or owned by municipalities or otherwise nonprofit entities. There's a great variety of both what you know, they have to deal with, their infrastructure. Montreal, for example, is very old pipes. Whistler has very new pipes. So it's hard to generalize about those. What we do know is that if you live under the direct care of the federal government, for example, if you're on a First Nations reserve, the chances of your water being safe are barely 50-50. And you really, the chances that you're in danger, possibly grave danger from your water, are unacceptably high. And I think that reflects the care that our federal government is taking for our water more generally. So, yeah, I mean, are we going to come down with huge intestinal problems? Not unless you happen to be misfortunate enough to live under the direct care of the federal government. But are we unprepared and undefended against some of these more exotic contaminants, which are the job of Ottawa to take care of? No, we're not safe at all.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking to us today, Chris Wood, who's a veteran author of more than 30 years and journalist and many other talents as well. We're talking to him today, courtesy of this month's Alternatives Journal article about his book, Down the Drain, How We're Failing to Protect Our Water Resources. Thank you very much, Chris.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the AJ Podcast. That was Darren Kaster interviewing author Chris Wood. Read an excerpt of Wood's book in the latest issue of Alternatives Journal to learn about the Canadian government's unacceptable care of our water, particularly on reserves. Visit us at alternativesjournal.ca to learn more about water issues and pick up a copy of the Food and Drink issue, which is on newsstands now. Thanks for listening, and here's Betty Seppel with Site 41 to end the show.
Purest water in this world, purer than a spring in the middle of the forest, purer than a melting glacier. Tell me, would you doom this water to contamination, or would you prioritize the well-being of a nation? Alice in aquifer, may we have the respect that you deserve? Tell me, would we really prefer to chlorinate our water in we show you respect that you deserve? Tell me, would we really prefer to create a plastic bottle for every time we're thirsty? And ooh, 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 the water. Water in this here world, sweeter than a river running through the forest, purer than the rainfall. Tell me, would it cross your mind even one brief time to pour all of our garbage onto it? And if somebody wanted to, what would be the appropriate way for us people to respond to it? Yeah, tell me, would we allow them to dam this water to contamination? Or would we demand they prioritize the well-being of our nation? Oh, Alice in aquifer, may we show you respect that you deserve? Tell me, would we really prefer to chlorinate our water in old Alice in aquifer, aquifer? May we have the respect that you deserve? Tell me, would we really prefer to create a plastic bottle for every time we're thirsty? And ooh,